Letter to the Romans. A survey of Romans chapter 1 through chapter 4. The first talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 30, 1997, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
One of the things that I have become committed to over the years in my life is the one kind of constant for me in my faith is the authority of the Bible. And I don't know, in the past we've had classes where I defended the authority of the Bible and the inerrancy of the Bible and that kind of thing, and we're not going to be doing that this year. But it really is the foundation of everything that I believe and everything that I do as a Bible teacher. What I'm committed to is, what is the Bible actually saying? You know, what did the author say in the book of Romans, Paul? What did Paul mean when he penned these words? And all too often over the course of my life, as I've watched different Bible teachers, I've realized that it's really kind of a misnomer. Most Bible teachers are not Bible teachers. They are students of theology. And they are students of a particular spin on theology, and they come at the, and they simply look at the Bible as a way of, as having a platform from which to teach their theology. One of the things that's probably aggravating to some people if they have listened to my teaching over the years is I keep changing. You know, the more I look at the text, the more I realize, you know, the way I have been looking at it before isn't really quite right. I need to change my mind. I need to adjust. Some of those adjustments have been relatively easy. Some of those adjustments have been anguish-filled times. I remember one paper I wrote a few years back where I set out to say one thing, and in the course of my studies, I realized I've been wrong. I've just been absolutely dead wrong for, you know, the last 10 years of my Bible teaching. And I spent a couple of sleepless nights, and the issue was, can I admit it or not? You know, can I really genuinely go this new direction, or should I fake it here? You know, should I obviously I didn't talk to myself in those terms, that would have been silly, but that was the truth. I mean, that really was the alternative. That what I was thinking is, well, maybe I can just go on believing what I've been teaching anyway, and I'll make the best case for it that I can. But in the end, I couldn't do that because it's not what the evidence. That's not where the evidence took me. It's that basic fundamental attitude toward the Bible that I think is shared kind of universally here at the Study Center that has led us to devise this new series, The Bible's Greatest Hits. Because one of the things that we've noticed over the last several years, going through and teaching topically, taking on different questions and different issues and speaking to those, all too many times, the response of people hearing this teaching was, well, that's all fine and good. You know, I see where you're coming from, but I don't agree with it. That would be fine if what they were saying is, I'm looking at the same Bible, I'm looking at the text, and I've come to a conclusion, and my conclusion as to what the text is saying is different from yours. That I could fully accept. I don't promise that I have infallible interpretations of the Bible. That's why I keep changing my mind. I'm looking for the infallible interpretation. I keep making mistakes, and so I know that someone may have a better interpretation of a biblical text than I do and may have much to teach me. But the problem is that wasn't the response of the people. It wasn't, I've understood this text in the Bible and it contradicts what you're saying and you can't be right. It was rather, I don't like that. I don't have to buy that. I don't agree with that. And one of the things we realized is we can't do anything for people who reject the authority of the Bible. Well, I have nothing to say to people. I shouldn't say I have nothing to say, but I'm not going to be able to persuade someone who is just willing to say the Bible's wrong. I'd rather look at life a different way than the way the Bible does. Okay, that you can take that up with God. But we were leaving the door open for people to walk away going, well, there's lots of different theologies out there, and I don't like the one at the study center. I want this other one instead. I like this other one instead. Well, that's not okay if you agree with me that the ground of the thing that should shape our beliefs, should rule our lives, should reign every part of our faith is the biblical revelation and what the biblical text is teaching us. If that's the case, then I can't just shine on what a Bible teacher is saying about a text. I have to argue with them. I have to defeat them. I have to persuade at least me, myself, that they've got it wrong for these reasons, and here's a better way to look at the text, and here's a better way to understand what the Bible is actually trying to reveal to me, what it's actually trying to say to me. That I can respect, and there's plenty of room for disagreement on that level. But I do not find acceptable that there's 25 different traditions of Christianity out there. Take your pick. I happen to like this one better. You don't have the right to like that one better if it's not true. And how will we know if it's not true? If it doesn't line up with the faith that's being conveyed to us and taught to us through the scriptures. So we decided we have to get back to the text. We have to go back and force you who are coming to listen here, we have to force you into a position where you have to say, not just, I don't like that, but that's not what it's saying. It's saying something else. It's teaching me something different, and you guys are wrong in the way you're looking at that. Because then at least we've taken you back to the source. And even if you don't agree with us then, that's fine. I mean, we can accept that. But let's work together to try to figure out what the text is saying. Now, having said that, we're doing something a little bit out of the ordinary for these first 3 weeks, because we're not going to really dive in depth to a particular text. I'm going to do this thing that Wes was talking about earlier, try to do a really quick overview and a really quick survey of the book of Romans. And as you can imagine, we won't be able to dwell very and delve very deeply into any given part of the text. We're just going to have to work in really broad outlines. Romans has been absolutely life-changing in my study of Romans over the years for me, and as it has throughout history. It changed the whole theoretical landscape. Augustine got his start by a verse in the book of Romans that really struck him, and as he studied further, changed his life. Ulrich Zwingli, the reformer in Zurich, his study of Romans was influential. It was true of Luther. It was true of Karl Barth later. Over and over again, people have kept stumbling over the book of Romans, and it's tended to change their lives in one way or the other. It's true of me as well. I used to think that the reason Romans was such a unique book is that that the purpose that Paul had in mind when he wrote the book was to just say, let me take it from the top here. This gospel that I preach, let me systematically present to you the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that no other book in the New Testament does that. Every other book in the New Testament seems to be addressing some problems or some questions or some issues that are going on in the lives of the Christian community that they're writing the letter to. And so whatever the author is saying is kind of directed to answer those questions. It's not just kind of a systematic presentation of here is the Christian faith. But Romans, I used to argue, that's pure stuff. That's unadulterated by problems and questions and issues. It's just Paul sitting down and saying, what's the Christian gospel? Let me tell you. Well, over the course of time, I realized that I had been misled by that. Because as a matter of fact, Romans is just as much directed at questions and issues and problems as any other book in the New Testament. He's out to set them straight on a particular problem. However, I wasn't completely wrong, because unlike the other books in the New Testament, the problem is pretty fundamental. The problem is a pretty basic problem, and that is, one way to put it would be, what must I do to be saved? There's a disagreement, there's a controversy over what I must do to be saved, and he's out to set the record straight on what the answer to that question is. So, both of those are good to keep in mind. It's not really just a systematic theology. It's not really just a systematic teaching of the gospel. That will mislead you if you think in those terms, on the one hand. On the other hand, there is no other book of the New Testament that dwells so exclusively and focuses so sharply on the question of how do I enter into eternal life? And that, of course, is the most important question in our whole existence. And I think that's why the book of Romans is so crucial and so important to master. Paul sneaks into the whole issue rather smoothly. You know, he spends the first 15 verses just kind of high and howdy, and here's what I've been up to, and I'm hoping to come and see you, and just a lot of personal kinds of stuff. But he ends that by saying in 14 and 15 of chapter 1, I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. Thus, for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Talks about his personal investment in this task, this project, this mission that he has to proclaim the gospel, to clarify the gospel to people. And then immediately he says, why am I so eager? For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So, I haven't appreciated until recently how key that verse is to setting up what he's going to do from here in the book. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation. The question that could be raised at that point, and that's the question he goes on to address for the next several chapters, the question is salvation. Salvation from what? What are we talking about? So he immediately, in verse 18, begins a section, a major section of the book of Romans, to explain that the reason he's not ashamed of the gospel is it involves salvation from the wrath of God. And it's a wrath that every human being, every individual on the face of the earth is confronting, is facing into the wrath of God. So he begins in 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them, and so on. And then he proceeds to basically tell the story that he thinks is the story that gets repeated in every human being's life. It's the story of history, it's the story of your life, it's the story of my life, it's the story of civilizations, it's the story of everything that human beings touch. And the story is that although it ought to be obvious, although it ought to be evident that there is a transcendent author of everything that exists, in whose hands we are, and in whose hands our existence is held, even though that's true and ought to be obvious, the really strange thing is we as human beings find a way to, as he puts it, suppress that truth. We find a way to ignore it, to dodge it, to dismiss it. And he describes the darkness of our mind, the foolishness of our reasonings. He takes example out of the pagan world, where we would literally create with our hands, out of stone or wood or something, images of animals, birds or four-footed animals, reptiles or whatever, and then call them the God who is the ultimate being that I must answer to and who is the answer to all my problems and the solution to all my fixes. And Paul says, if every one of us could get some objectivity, that's a big if we could get some objectivity, but if we could step back and get some objectivity on the things that we do, the things that we believe, the things that we think, the attitudes that we have about our lives, we'd realize that they are idiotic. They are just absolutely insane. We are completely and totally out of touch with reality. Now again, history is our own, that's the story of our own life. There's something in us that is this innate, inherent animosity toward God and everything that He is. We hate God, we are hostile to God, we reject God. Why? Because, as Bertrand Russell said, there's not enough evidence? No. It's not for lack of evidence. It's because we don't want to have any interaction with God. We don't want Him to be there. We don't want to have to deal with Him. We don't want to have to confront Him. And what's somebody to do who's in denial? We just forget it. Just pretend like it's not true. Pretend like it doesn't exist. And we tell ourselves stories about what reality is like and how it came into being and who we are. We just tell ourselves stories that make us feel good about the fact that we don't believe in this God, we don't obey this God, we don't honor this God, and we don't give thanks to this God. So that's what he describes throughout this whole next section. As the latter part of the section, he describes God's response to that. What did God do? Verse 24, he says, "Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them." And then he divides that into two categories. He gave them over in the desires of their hearts. Their deep down desires were given over to, they were given over to impurity. They were given over to what he calls degrading passions. And he uses the example there of homosexuality to illustrate that. And they were given over to a depraved mind, he says. And depraved is not exactly the best translation. To translate it, it sounds really anemic, but I think if we understand what Paul is saying, it's a very strong statement he's making. To translate it would just be a disapproved mind, an unacceptable mind. I think the idea is we were given over to minds that are poor excuses for minds. We were given over to minds that are so riddled full of foolishness that they really don't deserve to be called minds. They're no longer functioning like a human mind ought to be functioning. I think that's what he's trying to get at. And the fruit of that, he says, the fruit of that in our lives are these lives that are just filled with all kinds of corruption and perversion and self-centeredness and moral ugliness of one kind or the other. God gave them over to a depraved mind to do the things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, another Greek word for malice, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, those who practice such things are worthy of death. They not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. When you look at that list, there's no way you can look at the list that he lays out there, take it seriously, and not go, ouch. The fruit of our foolishness and the fruit of our giving over to degrading passions is that we are really morally despicable people. The only way we can escape that judgment is if we redefine goodness and redefine morality and lower the bar considerably. If we lower the bar enough, then we can begin to think that we measure up morally. But Paul's not lowering the bar for us. He's saying something as simple as our ordinary, everyday untrustworthiness is perverse. Human beings were not created by God to be untrustworthy creatures, to lie and to cheat and to lack integrity and to bend the rules and to manipulate people and to always play people for our advantage, the kind of untrustworthiness that we are engaging in every day of our lives all the time. Where is that coming from? It's coming from a moral brokenness that God has, the text says, given us over to. Now, what does he mean by that? I think what he means by that, and here I've changed my interpretation from past years. I think what he means by that is that God had two options when he confronted the, when he confronts the rebellion of mankind against himself, mankind's hostility to God and hostility to truth. He has two options. He can somehow stop it, rein it in, curb it, control it, put the lid on it, and try to not let it have its way, or he can let it go. And I think what Paul is saying is, what's the option that God chose in human history? He let it go. He has let human rebellion run its course in order that the human rebellion could be seen for what it is, in order that it could be manifest, in order that it could be out there in the open. Where is he going with all that? I think the key verses in this whole first section are 1 and 2 of chapter 2. Therefore, you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. And we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who do practice such things. The point that he's making is, you want evidence? Do you want proof that you are one of those people who's under the wrath of God? Look at your lives. You find this strange phenomenon. You look around you at all the other people in the world, and you know good and well that they are doing damnable things. Particularly, you recognize that when they make you the victim of those damnable things. When they rip you off, and when they lie to you, and when they cheat you, and they act cruelly to you, and they act disrespectfully to you, and they act unloving to you, and you realize how vicious it is, you realize how perverse that behavior is, and sometimes you wish them to be damned for what they do. But more than wishing them to be damned, you know that they really are objectively damnable for what they're doing. But then he says, the problem is, you do the same thing. The things that others do to you that you know are so damnable, you know you are fully capable and have done to others, fully capable of doing, and you have done to others. So that's where he's headed in this whole first part of the argument. Why am I so eager to preach the gospel to you? Because I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it's the power of God for salvation. Salvation from what? Salvation from the wrath of God that every one of us are going to have to face one day, because look at us. Look at the kind of people we are. Look at our moral unworthiness. Look how morally worthy of damnation, of condemnation that we are. That's what we're all facing into, and we desperately need to be saved from the fate that is our due, the condemnation that is our due. So that's why he's not ashamed of the gospel. Now, Paul could have, at that point, he could have gone right over into the middle of chapter 3, verse 19. We know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God, because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, and so on and so forth. We are justified by faith in Jesus instead. That's really at the heart of what the book of Romans is ultimately all about. Is are we justified by what he calls works of the law? I'll explain that later. Or are we justified by faith in Jesus Christ instead? That's really the heart of the issue. He could have jumped immediately to that issue. But there's this kind of, you could almost call it a parenthesis. It's not exactly parenthetical, but there's this tangent that he goes on that he seems to think is crucial. Starts in 3. Or do you suppose this, O man, when you pass judgment upon those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? You know, you're one of those people who finds damnable everything that everybody is doing, and you do it yourself, but somehow your attitude toward yourself is that doesn't apply to you. God's not going to damn you. Now, why does he do this? Primarily in this section, he has the Jew of his day in mind. I mean, he has himself in mind. Paul describes himself in other places as a Pharisee of Pharisees, before the law, blameless, and so on and so forth. Paul was a good Jew, very good Jew, before he became a Christian. He knows the psychology. He knows the mentality. He's very well familiar with it. And he and he realizes that so many of his brother Jews are in that same mentality, and he desperately wants to shake them out of that. He desperately wants them to see what it is that they need to see that's keeping them from recognizing the truth of who Jesus is. So he takes the rest of this chapter and the beginning of chapter 3 to attack that question, to address that particular reader. Why is it that such a person, a Jew of Paul's day, a Pharisaical Jew of Paul's day, why do they not see that they are under the wrath of God, that they're going to face into that same wrath in the final day? Two reasons come out in his discussion that in the rest of this chapter. Two reasons. One is that by physical descent, that person belongs to the chosen people of God. And so by a kind of slippery sort of logic, a slippery sort of reasoning, if I'm one of the children of God, surely of all the people who are not going to be condemned by God, it is his own children. It is his own people. And so if I am part of that people, surely he will not damn me. And secondly, and these kind of went hand in hand, I think, for most people in Paul's position, most Pharisees of that day, by religious zeal, these people are champions of God's law. You can't get to be better fans of the law of God than the Pharisaical Jews of Paul's day. So by physical descent, God has made promises to the lineage, the physical lineage of Abraham, that makes them promises that they will be the people of God. And by religious zeal, they are real, they're on God's team. If anybody's on God's team, these people are on God's team. If anyone is going to be justified in God's eyes, surely it is us. And do I do some of the bad things? Well, yeah, I suppose. But, you know, I'm just human, after all. That mentality is capable of finding a way to minimize and to trivialize out-and-out perversion, out-and-out distortions of what a human being ought to be. We can just find a way of dismissing that. And because these other things loom larger, these other things that I think are things in my credit, to my advantage, loom larger. Paul says three things in response to them. First of all, he says, your stubborn refusal to acknowledge your moral unworthiness is going to condemn you at the final judgment. That is, there's a moral blindness going on here. The fact that you can trivialize your disobedience and hold on to and place your hope in your physical lineage and your religious zeal, that's a kind of moral blindness that's going to damn you at the judgment. That's what he's saying, I think, in 3 and following. I'm sorry, 4 and following. Do you think lightly of the riches of his kindness and forbearance and patience, not knowing the kindness of God leads you to repentance? I think what he means by that is intended to lead you to repentance. But because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God. You really don't get it, and you're really not getting it does not bode well for your future. You're going to be damned, my friend, he says. Secondly, he makes the point that it is not enough to champion the law of God in order to qualify for eternal life, and in fact, he would argue, in order to qualify as a person in good standing of the people of God, even. It's not enough to champion the law of God, he says. You have to do it. You have to personally embrace it in such a way that you take the law of God on and you decide, yes, I'm going to strive to live my life according to that law. That person, that Jew, and only that Jew, is someone who has any hope of being seen as justified in God's eyes and entering into eternal life. But he's saying, that's not where you guys are at. You guys are what he calls hearers of the law without being doers of it. But as he says in verse 13, it's not the hearers of the law who are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. So championing, can't say that, championing the law is in and of itself of really no value in terms of our justification. And the zeal that goes with it is of no consequence ultimately. And being a Jew doesn't change that. God is going to, he says, God is not partial. There is no partiality with God. In the judgment, he's going to judge Jews and Gentiles on exactly the same terms. The question he's going to ask is not, are you Jewish? The question he's going to ask is, did you do the law? And he goes so far as to make the point that a Gentile who's never had the law revealed to him, but if by some accident of history, this Gentile finds himself keeping the law of God, Paul says it's as if he had the law written in his heart, and he's going to be more the Jew than the Jew who, having the law, does not keep it. He, at the end of the chapter, he says it in terms of, will not this uncircumcised who keeps the law, will not his uncircumcision become circumcision? And won't the law, won't the Jew who is circumcised, if he doesn't keep the law, won't his circumcision be treated as uncircumcision? I mean, that he's just simply dramatizing the point that the external symbols of your commitment to keep the covenant are worthless. It's only the reality of your heart striving to keep the covenant that is of any value in God's eyes at all. And then finally, the third point that he makes, I don't know if I should separate this from the last one. In my notes here, I have it separated out. I've sort of talked about it. It's not physical descent that makes one a favored person who will be blessed as a member of the people of God. It is in keeping God's law. The Gentile who keeps God's law is favored in God's eyes, whereas the Jew who does not is not favored. So those are the points that he makes in chapter 2 and going into chapter 3, addressing as a kind of a tangent. Those of you who think that you don't have the problem of God's wrath to solve, let me warn you that you do. You face the wrath of God at the final judgment, whether you appreciate it or not, whether you understand it or not, whether you dig it or not, it's coming, and you better come to terms with it. That's, I think, why that's there. Then in chapter 3, in the middle of chapter 3, he returns to, first in a kind of transition section in 9 through 18, what then, are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. He basically comes to summarize the issue that he's been talking around for the last two chapters. The bottom line of all that discussion is, look, you guys, I don't care who you are, you can be Greeks or you can be Jews, but we're all under sin. And in this context, the import of that is, we all are under the wrath of God unless something solves that problem. So with that in mind, then, he comes to the heart of what this book is written for in verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God, because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Okay. In the past, I've tried to interpret this book of Romans as if Paul has set us up a little better for this statement than I think, in fact, he actually has. I don't think Paul has set us up any more, in the way I'm looking at it now, I don't think he's set us up for this any more than to simply emphasize that we have this problem of the wrath of God. Okay, but how can we deal with the wrath of God? Well, a good Jewish answer to that would be, well, we need to keep the law. And Paul, here in 19 and 20, is saying, that ain't going to work. Nobody is going to be able to be justified in God's eyes by just sitting down today and deciding, you know what, I'm going to repent of my rebellion against God, and from now on, I'm going to keep the law and thereby make God happy with me. Say, it's not going to work that way. The reason it's not going to work that way is because even if you could, and that's a pretty big if, even if I could just kind of repent of my rebellion and lay that aside, even if I could do that, I still wouldn't end up being a morally worthy person. What I would end up being is a person who is just leaking evil out of every pore, desperately trying to stop it up. Now, that desperately trying to stop it up is not a bad thing. And in fact, in the end, rightly understood, that person is going to enter into eternal life. I didn't look at that passage, but that's implicit in what he talks about, in how he describes the judgment in chapter 2. I won't take the time to get into that. But that will be one aspect of what it means to be a believer in Jesus, is that you will be someone who takes sin so seriously that we do everything we can to root it out of our lives and remove it from us and avoid it and so on and so forth. That's a very good thing to do. But as good a thing to do as it is, the person who's leaking evil out of every pore is not a good person and is not a morally worthy person. Such a person has not earned the right to inherit the blessing of eternal life. That's why Paul says, I think, what he does, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those of us who are under the law, that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God." If you really take the law on in the way that you would have to take it on to stop your rebellion against God and say, you know, I'm really going to love God and know Him and obey Him now. If anyone really took that on, what they would find is it is impossible for them to conform their life to the moral standards of the law of God. And what they would do is realize how morally corrupt, how morally perverse, how morally despicable they are. And it leaves you speechless before God. You realize that before the judgment seat of God, what are you going to say in your own defense? Joe was worse? I mean, you're just absolutely devastated. You're left realizing, I have nothing I'm going to be able to say in my own defense. Why, he says? Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. It's only by taking the law on that I really come to any kind of self-awareness and any kind of self-understanding. I realize, boy, I'm a sinner. I'm helplessly and hopelessly a sinner. Now, I probably most of us can speak to that from our own experience. There's something very convenient about being a rebel against God. Being a rebel against God, you can always lie to yourself and tell you, well, if I really wanted to obey God, I would. The only person who really knows how bad off they are is the person who stops wanting to disobey God and starts wanting to obey God. And then you find, as much as you want to obey God, it ain't happening. And then you realize, ooh, there's something wrong with me. I am not a good person. With all my apologies to Mr. Rogers, I am not a good person. So he says, what's the alternative? The alternative, he says, is that God has a whole other way devised whereby people like you and I who are morally broken can nonetheless be justified in God's eyes. And that's what he describes in 21 and following. But now apart from the law, my translation has righteousness. I'm convinced that what he means, the way Paul uses this Greek word here, if we could coin a word, I would coin justifiedness, that's what he means. But now apart from the law, the justification in God's eyes that comes from God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, that is, the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures have been telling us that this is what this is all about. Even the justifiedness which comes from God to those people who believe on the basis of their belief in Jesus. That, Paul says, that's the alternative. The alternative to being damned is to realize that God is willing to grant as a gift, to grant as a purely as an act of mercy on his part, to just decide, you know, I'm going to justify Jack. I'm going to grant him justification in my eyes. Why am I going to do that? Has he earned it? Oh, no. No, but I just want to do that. Now, I suppose, I don't know, this is certainly debatable, and I'm not sure I really have any firm convictions about this. In another world that God created, could God have just willy-nilly, invisibly granted justification to me? I don't know, maybe. But he didn't do it that way. He did it by a very strange event in human history. He became man. He became the very same man who ultimately is destined to be king of the entire universe, king of the entire cosmos. But he became that man and entered into history and entered into a little plot of political intrigue such that he ended up being crucified on a cross by the Romans in the first century. And he did that because God had a much huger drama in mind in doing that. And when you get to something like the book of Hebrews, he spells out in much more detail how he understands what's going on there. He goes back to the Old Testament and he says, Jesus dying on the cross was like the high priest going into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement and sprinkling the blood of an animal on the mercy seat as an offering to God, appealing to God for mercy. The high priest, on behalf of the people, offered up a propitiatory offering. And a propitiatory offering is just something that you would offer a divine being, would offer a God, in hopes that it would appease their wrath, pleading for that God for mercy. So the high priest goes in and offers a propitiatory offering to God, appealing to God for mercy, and presumably, the nation receives mercy from God based on what the high priest has done. The author of Hebrews says, when Jesus died on the cross, Jesus himself was like the high priest entering into the Holy of Holies and offering a propitiatory offering. And what did he offer as a propitiatory offering? His own body. He offered up a propitiatory offering to God, appealing to God for mercy. And now, why would we appeal to God for mercy? Because God is angry with us. And why is he angry with us? Because we are morally corrupt people and worthy of nothing but condemnation. So, Paul says, it's all this is through Jesus Christ because God publicly displayed Jesus as this propitiatory offering to God, appealing to God for mercy. And those people who put their faith in Jesus, that is, those people who believe in Jesus, are those who are going to be justified in God's eyes. In other words, when we respond positively to the role that Jesus is playing, then God grants us the mercy that we are appealing for. If we don't respond positively to it, then God does not grant mercy. He doesn't actually say that, but that's implicit in what he's saying. That there is no mercy granted to people who reject the role that Jesus is playing on our behalf. Now, notice back in chapter 2, I mentioned that the thing he says to the Jews is that your stubborn and unrepentant heart is manifest by the fact that you just refuse to acknowledge that you're bad people. You refuse to acknowledge that your sin is a serious offense against God and worthy of condemnation. That really comes down to the same thing ultimately as rejecting Jesus. Why would anyone respond positively to the story of Jesus, this interpretation of what is happening as this man is dying on the cross? Why would anyone respond positively to that if they didn't really think that they were in danger of condemnation? If they didn't really think that God had anything serious against them? It's only people who have come to the kind of self-awareness and the kind of self-knowledge that they realize how desperately damned they are. Only those people are going to hear the news that, lo and behold, God has sent his high priest into the world to offer up a propitiatory offering in order that we might receive mercy from God. Only people who believe that they need mercy from God are going to go, really? Whoa. That's good news. That's a good story. And therefore, Paul says, that's how we know who God is granting this gift of justification to. He's granting this gift of justification to the people who have enough self-awareness, whose eyes have been opened, supernaturally God has opened their eyes so that they are open to the truth. They are tender toward God. They are no longer hostile to God. They no longer hate God. God has transformed their heart, made them open to the truth, made them open to the truth about themselves in particular, who hear what God says he's doing in the world, in the form of Jesus, in the man of Jesus, and go, wow, that's the answer to my most urgent problem. Those are the people who have been granted justification in God's eyes, Paul says. Then he goes on, in the end of 3, the very last verse of 3 and into 4, to say, am I making this up? Am I throwing out all of the Old Testament scriptures, everything the prophets have said, everything that's been revealed to us through our history as a people, the Jews? Am I dismissing all of that and just making all this stuff up? Is this some newfangled religion that I'm inventing? That's what he means in 31 when he says, do we then nullify the law through faith? We may not understand that at first, but if we don't understand that one of the things that Paul means when he uses the term law, it's not the only thing, but one of the things that he can mean by that is what any Jew of his day would have meant, and that is the Old Testament scriptures. The Jews divided the law into the law, the prophets, and the writings. And their full name for their scriptures was the law, the prophets, and the writings. But that's a mouthful, so oftentimes they would shorten it, and often they would shorten it to the law and the prophets, instead of the law and the prophets and the writings. But more typically, they would shorten it just to the law. And it was just a label that they would use to refer to the entire corpus of the Old Testament scriptures. That's the way he's using it in verse 31. Do we then nullify the law through faith? Are we throwing out the scriptures and ignoring them? May it never be. On the contrary, we establish the law, he says. And then he proceeds to point to evidences in chapter 4, evidences in the Old Testament that confirm his interpretation of the gospel. He says three things. He says, first of all, if in the text of Genesis 15:6, we have that statement where the text of Genesis says, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness or justifiedness, as his justification. He says, what is it that the text says was the basis for Abraham being justified in God's eyes? Not his moral perfection, not his moral worthiness, not his obedience to God and his great moral character. It's God came along and made a promise, and Abraham believed it. And Paul says that's highly significant. That's what I'm saying this is all about. That's what we see in the gospel, is that the one who is going to be granted justification in God's eyes are people just like Abraham, their father, who are really children of Abraham in the sense that when God comes along and makes a promise about what he intends to do for them and bless them with, they believe it. That was the basis of Abraham's justification. Therefore, in the gospel, it makes sense that it will be the basis of our justification. Then he quotes a psalm where David is writing, and he speaks of a blessing being granted to him who is a sinner. And their sin and their moral unworthiness, however, is forgiven by God. God just decides, yeah, you sinned, but it's forgiven. And David says, that person is indeed blessed, who God will come to and say, your sin is forgiven. Well, you know, that's the reason he finds that so significant, is it's really explicitly out there in black and white, the need actually for there to be forgiveness in order for justification to occur. Really, that's not really the category that the Jews were accustomed to thinking in terms of. Granted, God was merciful, and they would acknowledge the mercy of God, but it's a mercy that you earned. And what Paul is trying to emphasize is, David seems to be talking here about a mercy that's not earned, but merely granted. And that's a whole different kind of concept. So he says, there's another place in the Old Testament where that's completely in line with what I'm saying. then he raises the question, okay, but for whom is this justification given as a gift and forgiveness simply granted by God? To Jews or to Gentiles? And he makes a very, very interesting argument. He says, well, both. And how do I know it's both? Well, let's look at Abraham. He says, Abraham, when the text came along and said, and Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, all you Bible quiz people, did that happen before he was circumcised or did it happen after he was circumcised? The right answer is before he was circumcised. He says, well, then he was sort of a Gentile, wasn't he? He didn't really become a Jew until after that event. God came and made another aspect of the covenant with Abraham. And no, he didn't make another aspect. He repeated the promise that he had previously made to Abraham. He repeated it again, and he sealed that promise with a covenant, and the sign of that covenant was circumcision. But the way Paul is interpreting the Genesis account, and I believe he's absolutely right to interpret it that way, is that why did God come along and sign this contract with Abraham, sealing the promise that he had already made to him previously? Why did he do that? Because Abraham had demonstrated himself to be someone who wanted the promise. He had believed God. He had responded positively to it. And I think it's fair to say that from Paul's perspective, if Abraham had not responded favorably to it and positively to it, God would have said, okay, oh well, I guess you don't want it, and gone away. But Abraham, by God's grace, did not respond that way, was not that sort of person. He was a person whose eyes had been opened and realized that his whole life and his whole existence was worthless in this futile world that we live in. And here is this God telling me that he's going to bless me with this blessing. Whatever it is, I don't altogether understand it, but I want it. And he had this basically miraculous kind of faith. And it's that miraculous kind of faith that the Genesis text says was the basis for him being justified in God's eyes. But yet he wasn't really the beginning of the Jewish people as we know them, as we came to know them, until he was circumcised. So Paul says, look, he's really the father of the Gentiles who believe, and he's the father of the Jews who believe. God made two promises. He promised that he would make him the father of many nations. And how is it that God is the father of many nations? He's the father of many nations because people from every tribe and people and family on the earth are going to find their way to emulate the faith of their father Abraham. They are going to be, in a sense, his spiritual children. And they are going to be inherit the blessing that was promised to Abraham because they are his children in that sense. But there's a whole other set of promises that God made to Abraham that were about what was going to happen to his physical seed, his physical descendants. Those are the physical descendants of Abraham. But Paul is careful to point out, but you have to understand, the physical descendants of Abraham are only really Abraham's children if they not only are physically descended from Abraham, but they also follow in the footsteps of his faith. Only then are they really his children. That's the point he makes here. But all that's, ultimately, he garners all that in that evidence in order to make the point, I don't care if you are Jew or you are a Gentile. For Jew and Gentile alike, the way in which we can be justified in God's eyes is by believing the promises of God, by our faith. We're basically out of time, so what I'm going to do is leave chapter 5 for next week. We'll pick up in chapter 5 and try to make it all the way to 11, chapter 11. So for now, did you want to take a break?
Take
or do
a
you want?
Break
oh, okay, we'll take a 5-minute break. And
I'll be glad to go first, but I don't
please,
need to.
Please do.
This is phenomenally good news, 1 through 4. And I've always wondered why in chapter 1, verse 16, he said that he's not ashamed of it. Did you already talk about that?
Not specifically. The only thing, I'm not actually absolutely sure, but he does say in 14, I am under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to foolish. what that suggests to me is that Rome, the cultural center of the Roman Empire and civilization and everything, probably feeling pretty good about itself and its wisdom and its culture and its power and so on, that they think of themselves as sophisticated, with it, cool people. And the tendency would may very well be to look down on not only Christianity, but even maybe even Judaism, but Judaism and certainly Christianity as just something for simple, idiot, barbarian folks. And it's not anything that intellectual sophisticates would be at all interested in. And so he's saying, no, I feel obligated to both, and I'm not ashamed of it. So I don't mind coming into Rome and declaring this and proclaiming this, and the reason I don't feel embarrassed is we're talking about salvation here, and wise people and barbarians are both under the wrath of God and damned if they don't figure this out. So I'm not ashamed. I think that's...
Don't you think that we have kind of the same feeling today in certain places, particularly,
oh, yeah,
I think going down to the university, you know, it's really just the way people maybe just naturally act or whatever, but that this sort of comes out, just, what are you, kind of an idiot, or, you know,
yeah,
come on, wise up. And
well, I don't know if I could count on all my hands and fingers, all my toes and fingers, the times that people have said to me, oh, you're a Christian? You seem too smart to be a Christian, or something to that effect. I never quite know how to respond. I go, oh, thank you. Rebecca, is that a hand? Okay.
I have questions for some people. You said that, and of course this is confuses me. God sent Jesus to give God a plea for forgiveness. And, I mean, he's the subject and he's also... So he's doing something to himself, basically.
For himself.
Uh-huh. For himself.
Yeah, that's the part that I must say I'm really not sure that I understand how the apostles are thinking about that. Did God send Jesus to offer up a propitiatory offering for God's sake or for my sake, for our sake, for mankind's sake? Most Orthodox Christians would probably be outraged if we took the position that he did that for our sake. And what I mean by that is, if he did it merely for our sake, then conceivably God could have found another way to provide the ground for our justification, the basis for our justification, in principle, in theory. He could have, but in the world that he created here and the history that he created here, he decided to do it this way, having his son die on the cross. There's something in us that's been ingrained in us who've been raised in the Christian culture that balks at that. What we want to believe is that it was absolutely logically necessary for Jesus to die on the cross, that God himself required it, and nothing short of that would have made it even possible for God to forgive us. That may be true. If it's true, I don't altogether understand why it's true, but it may very well be true. But it's not clear to me that it's true. It seems to me that you could read the apostles' writing and their description of the cross, and it would be perfectly consistent with what they're saying, that in fact, it was simply a device, not the only logically, not a device that's logically required, but the device that God happens to have chosen to confront us with the question, do you or do you not need propitiation?
Was it a device or the device?
That's the question. Wait.
Yeah.
Are you asking...
many devices to that God, throughout
okay.
the cultures that are...
It's the device in the sense that Jesus said, I am the way, and I am the truth, I am the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. It's the device in the sense that there's no other there's no other comparable thing in all of human history and all of human culture and all human religions. Nothing else plays the role that Jesus' death on the cross played. Now, having said that, can God get himself into a person's life and find a way to confront them with the issue of their need for mercy in any other way? I think so. I think he did with Abraham. And everybody in history who preceded Jesus, God was able to accomplish the same, what the New Testament calls sanctification. He was able to sanctify them, call them out and make them distinctive people, marching to the beat of a different drum, his children, not children of the devil. He was able to do that with them having no knowledge of Jesus at all. So in principle, it seems like God can do that. But from the standpoint of the story that God was telling in history, I think Jesus' death on the cross is an absolutely indispensable element of that story. It is the device God has chosen to serve as the propitiatory offering, the appeal to God for mercy. And I think one of the implications of that is, if you were to bring Abraham now onto the scene and say, now I know you didn't know this, but did you know that God became man in Jesus and died on the cross as the propitiatory offering? I think what the apostles would tell you is, no way would Abraham have gone, no, come on. Instead, he would have gone, wow, okay. That's what we needed. I need to embrace the severity, the gravity of my sin.
You were talking about kind of a process where, or maybe it's not a process in your mind, but someone realizes their moral depravity and then believes in Jesus. So basically, Jesus' propitiation was the offer of forgiveness or the offer of covenant, but the believing in that that will actually happen is parallel to what Moses did. What Moses' belief caused him to have righteousness.
You mean Abraham?
Abraham.
Yeah. Let's see. If I followed you, yeah. Yeah. So that my
the offering is sent here. This is available. You can take it.
Yeah.
Okay. But could you kind of, because I'm always wondering, what does believing in Jesus mean? People always say that. What does it mean?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, because otherwise it's just a slogan. I mean, just an empty phrase that we use. There are different, simply, it means to believe that the claims about who Jesus is and what role he plays in history and in my life are true, that those are true claims. What are those claims? I don't know if I can list all of them, but off the top of my head, it includes the claim that he is the Mashiach, the anointed one, the one who has been appointed by God to rule as king over the final kingdom of God in the age to come. He is the king. It includes that claim, I think. It includes the claim that I described as Jesus coming as our high priest and functioning as our high priest and making atonement or propitiating God's wrath so that we would not be crushed by the wrath of God, but that God would have mercy on us instead. And he played that instrumental role both as the high priest and as the offering itself. It includes that claim. Those are the two most important ones, but if I was more knowledgeable, I could probably spin out maybe other lesser important aspects of who Jesus is. But, you know, if somebody who knew what they were talking about could come along and spell out, here's what's true about Jesus, to believe in Jesus is to hear that claim made and go, okay, that's true. And not just at an intellectual level, but really to embrace it, to live my life in the light of that being true. It makes a difference that Jesus is king, and it makes a difference that he's the propitiation for my sins. And am I living my life and conducting my life from here on out in the light of those things being true? That's what it means to believe in Jesus. We really pervert that. We turn that into, I don't even know if it has content for a lot of people.
I was like looking through the Bible myself, trying to figure out what does this mean? What does it say about Jesus? What is it I'm supposed to believe about him specifically? Where he went, or what do I have to believe about him that is this faith that's spoken about?
In Romans 10, he'll put it, confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, which basically is what I call Messiah, Mashiach. And to confess your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. So there he links it to his Messiahship and his resurrection. Because the resurrection is so key, is such a key element in understanding the role that Jesus played.
But don't you think it's more just who you are, how you approach it, how you see it? I mean, it's sort of like a switch that's occurred to, and your eyes are opened and your heart is open. I mean, whatever is open, I don't know what it is, but and you might not know almost any of this, but just in its process maybe of learning it, but it's just that openness, it seems like, is what faith is.
Yeah, that's the thing that's been such a radical shift in my thinking over the years, is that Paul in Romans is going to talk about being justified by faith, and how I always used to interpret that, and I think a lot of people do interpret that, to mean that it's the act of believing itself that somehow has some saving power in our lives. And probably a typical Christian these days is thinking something along those terms. I don't think that's what the apostles are getting at. What the apostles are getting at is, you want a litmus test to tell whether your heart has been opened, your eyes have been opened, whether God has been doing a number on you that is indicative of the fact that you have been justified in his eyes, granted justification in his eyes, and that you've been chosen to be a child of God. One of the most important surefire litmus tests is, what do you do with the claims made about Jesus? Do you believe them, or do you scoff at them? If you believe them, a miracle has been happening in your heart. Akin to the, I talked about the miraculous thing that happened in Abraham's life. And when you think about it, it was really amazing that Abraham responded the way he did. He's a polytheist from Ur who believes in all kinds of gods, and one of a god comes to him one day and says, Abraham, I want you to move, and I'm going to bless you, and all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed to you. Yeah. Oh, right, yeah. I mean, why on earth did he believe that? I think, if I understand my own belief and your belief and New Testament belief, it's probably the same explanation. Because God was not just objectively making a promise to him, he was doing a number on his heart as well. He was opening his heart to recognize that this was real. Something about this was true. This wasn't just the same old mumbo-jumbo that was happening down the street. This was different. This was the real thing. Keish?
Question. I don't know exactly how I should ask this, but was Jesus before he manifested himself on the earth?
No.
Okay, so if you were to say then that Abraham was presented Jesus, he would believe in him. And since Jesus isn't on the earth now, then how could there be a Jesus? Do you know what I'm saying? Jesus isn't Jesus as a carpenter's son anymore. He's not that was just a brief moment in time. But who is Jesus?
He is right now seated at the right hand of God. Now, don't ask me what that looks like. I think that's just a metaphor. That's just a picture. But the metaphor that's being used is, he has really won the decisive victory to claim the people out of the world for himself that he intends to take captive to himself. That's one of the images that the Bible uses. Paul refers to this in Ephesians, quoting a psalm, is that Jesus has gone into the world and taken captives, and he's leading captives back to present them to God as now belonging, as servants to God, as belonging to God now, because he's gone out and waged war and taken us captive and brought us back to the temple for God. That's kind of the imagery that's been used. So we're captives that have been taken captive by Christ and have been led back to become servants of God. Why was I saying that? So, yeah, thank you. So the decisive victory, he's through the death and on the cross and the resurrection, there's a sense in which that was a decisive act, a decisive event that was the turning point in cosmic history that I think it's viewed as the thing that Jesus did to finally qualify him fully for his role as king of the universe. The problem is there's a few mop-up operations that are going to have to go on before this world really belongs to Jesus and is under his rule, but he really does rightly rule now in a way that he didn't rule before the resurrection. And so in 1 Corinthians 15, he describes it as waiting until God makes his enemies a footstool for his feet. That is, that God is going to finally crush the enemies of God and the enemies of Jesus, and the world is going to be judged, it's going to be destroyed, and at which point the enemies of Jesus are going to become a footstool for his feet, and he's going to then rule as king, uncontested, unchallenged by anyone. I mean, that's sort of the metaphor. So right now, he's just waiting for the final victories that are going to finally secure the world as completely and utterly under his rule. And that's described as him sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. So, is he Jesus now? Yes. Is he Jesus on the world walking among us? No. But he is somehow, somewhere, a human being in human form, or at least will be in human form again. That all depends on what happens to human being when they're between bodies. I just don't know. But when he became incarnated as a man, he became incarnated for all time. That seems to be the picture. He took on human form for all eternity. God has decided to actually enter into his creation permanently and become a creature in the form of this man Jesus. And so for the rest of eternity, he will literally be a flesh and blood king who is God himself,
so
become man.
He had no form.
But I would say before that, he was just God himself. He was just the transcendent, invisible God himself.
And he just decided to manifest himself.
See,
I can get it theoretically, but like when I look out to my life or when I live my life, I really don't apply this person, Jesus, very much into my life. It seems very theoretical.
Well, there's two ways that Christians try to do that. A lot of us have that problem. The way for Jesus to become tangible, a lot of Christians try to make Jesus tangible by...
And I read the stories, have the pictures, I hear the lectures. And, when I'm driving my car, it's really, it doesn't seem like
it. Right. I think it takes time. I think it takes time living with and under these truths. And over the course of time, they become more and more real and more relevant to driving the car. They don't seem automatically, and they shouldn't seem automatically relevant. I mean, we shouldn't be ashamed if Jesus seems so remote and so abstract, because frankly, he is pretty remote and he is pretty abstract. He's off at the right hand of the throne of God, which I think, whatever it is, seems to be a far way away, and he's a historical figure. And both of those things distance him from us. The only thing that brings him close in the right way is when I understand that this historical figure is my hero. He has brought about my salvation. But it takes time of living our lives in the light of the gospel for that really to sink in. When I was your age, I would have said exactly the same thing as you're saying. But I don't say that anymore. He's become much more real to me, much more relevant to me, because I've lived my life for a while in the light of the fact that this is true, and it's really become more tangible to me. But it's taken years. Now, what a lot of Christians try to take a shortcut, and they think that if Jesus is not real and tangible to me right now, then somehow I'm not very spiritual. You know, there's something spiritually wrong with me. And what they do, basically, is employ their imagination. And they make up an imaginary friend named Jesus who runs with them and walks with them and talks with them and is there every time. And whenever they need him, he gives them a hug and so on. Well, that's all fine and good, but it has nothing to do with biblical faith. God has never asked us to conjure Jesus up through our imagination.
Well, see, I think that's what I did when I was a kid.
Right.
And even when I pray to Jesus now, it's not in this image that he's at the right hand of the Father in some distant place. He's with the lambs and the children still. Mm-hmm. I mean, to tell you the truth.
Well, he's been promoted. You know, to be perfectly honest, I don't really visualize him anywhere. You know, when I
don't either. That's why I think it's really intangible. Much, what I'm saying.
Right.
Is it really a person? You know, the person that I'm praying to, because this person isn't right here. You know, in the flesh.
Yeah, it's really been only in recent years that I've realized it escapes our notice that Jesus is a human being. Even now, he's a human being. And that, you know, I've always treated him as just kind of a ghost. Yeah, a satellite. Yeah, yeah, sort of. But he's not. He's flesh and blood like me, and will be for all eternity. I mean, that's really weird. I mean, that's really amazing. Pardon me? Yeah, that's right. I forgot. Go.
I don't know if we have time for this question, but this is about chapter 3. Where Paul is talking in 10, there is no one righteous, not even one.
Mm-hmm.
All have turned away, they have together become worthless. Sometimes when the word all is used, it doesn't really mean every human person.
Mm-hmm.
How about this case? And I guess I kind of think about this when I'm talking with, you know, maybe my parents about their belief on maybe John the Baptist, who was conceived in sin, but was born of bodily sin, or Mary, who was immaculate conception, those types of things. So when I'm questioning them about that, I say, well, how do you arrive at that? And I say, well, this is how I arrive. What is Paul talking about every human person, and how do we know?
Well, no, I don't think so. Not in the sense that we can use this as evidence against the sinlessness of the Virgin Mary, because we couldn't use this as an argument against the sinlessness of Jesus, for example. It's not his intention, and I think that's something we have to appreciate about biblical interpretation. That's how we abuse the Bible so much, is that we seek to mine it for information that answers questions that they're not even worried about. Paul is not thinking about the Virgin Mary when he pens this. What is he thinking about? Why is he saying all this? What is he getting at? What he's getting at is he wants the readers to face into and own the reality of their own sinfulness, and therefore the doom that they are under. That's what he wants to do. If Jesus were to read this, should that be true of him? No. He's an exception, but he would know that he's an exception. I mean, he could figure that out. We don't need to worry about him. The question that's relevant is, how am I supposed to relate to what he's saying? And in the final analysis, he gives us the argument. I mean, we don't even have to take it on his authority, in a sense, that I am a sinner. I, Jack, don't have to take it on Paul's authority that I'm a sinner. He gives me the argument in 2:2. He says, what do you think objectively is real and true about people who do evil things out there? And I have to confess, I think they're damnable. And then he just says, okay, watch yourself. And you can't have it both ways. I mean, it can't, the same action cannot be damnable for that person and okay for you. And you can't, you just can't have it both ways. So that's really his argument for the my sinfulness, and he's really not concerned about doctrines that say other people are sinless. He's worried about what I think about myself. So unfortunately, it means that we can't really legitimately go here and say, well, this says all, so therefore it means all without exception. Well, no. That, if he were arguing the case, if he was asking the question, now are there any exceptions to the rule that every human being is a sinner, then we could take his words at face value. But as things are now, we have to say it's ambiguous. He could be saying that, but how could I know, because that wasn't the question he's addressing. Is that a hand, Amy? No.
Just to tag on the end of that, I was going to say, it's kind of interesting that it's almost a very revealing facet of human nature that it's like we read something like that and we want to find exceptions. I mean, even that is somewhat of, a kind of indicator of the problem that the very statement is addressing. I mean, you know, we read something like, there is no one righteous, and we go, oh, really? Well, you know, let's see if I can beat that, you know. Let's say, you know, let's really flesh that out. Let me make sure, are you being absolutely positive? You know, I mean, we don't understand what it's really trying to say. Instead, we want to combat it, and we want to argue with it, and we want to make sure that, because if it is true that statement is, you can't take that at face value, it's being absolutely true, there are exceptions, aha, then maybe that leaves room for us, or it's wrong, or there's any number of things we can do. I mean, it's just...
And the most important thing is, as long as I can keep arguing with you about whether there's absolutely nobody that's righteous, I don't have to ask whether I am righteous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's our way of kind of avoiding really thinking about what the verse is addressing,
yeah,
and what it wants us to...
Yeah. One last question here, then we'll need to leave.
Well, I'm often involved in discussions among people with different variants of their Christian background. What, in your mind, are the essential elements of being a Christian? What beliefs must a person have to be considered a Christian? I mean, you know, can you give me, like, a list of beliefs that you think a person, if someone told you, okay, is this Lee Young or someone else a Christian, you would ask them, well, do you believe this and this and this? And based on whether they believe those things, you would say, yes, this person is a Christian, and they are.
Well,
as I said, there's so many variants of Christianity, right, and some of them kind of think that they have a monopoly on truth, right, and if you don't believe as they do, then you're not a Christian, particularly with regard to what you were saying earlier. The variants of Christianity that believe you have to have this personal relationship with Jesus as a friend that's by your side all the time will say, if you don't have that personal relationship, you're not a Christian, even though you may have all the other beliefs that a lot of churches would define as Christianity.
Well, that's a really hard question to answer, because on the one hand, what I want to say is you really ultimately could not reduce the Christian faith to a set of beliefs, because it's not really about believing beliefs. On the one hand, I want to say that. On the other hand, that's not altogether true. It is about believing beliefs. It kind of comes back to what Jean was talking about. Ultimately, what makes you and I a child of God is not what we believe, but what we're open to believing. That is, what we don't have any moral blindness that keeps us from believing. It's the absence of moral blindness, or the waning of moral blindness might be more accurate. It's the waning of moral blindness in my life that marks me as a child of God, not the degree of intellectual commitment to the right truths. That will follow, because if I'm no longer morally blind, then I've eliminated a huge obstacle to my arriving at what's true about life and reality and God and me and everything else. That's been my biggest obstacle. Is one of the reasons I haven't believed the things that are true is, frankly, I haven't wanted to. But now that that's out of the way, I still might have intellectual problems, and I still might have basically emotional prejudices. I mean, that's one of the things you see among Jews today, for example, is that even if you were to take a Jew and God were to sanctify them so they are not morally blind to the truth, there's still this huge emotional barrier. Their whole identity. One of the things I've heard Rabbi Lapin say, the guy that we're going to have come and speak at the Oktoberfest, one of the things he said is, the strangest thing is, in America today, if a Orthodox Jew's child becomes a Buddhist, that's cool. Or a Hindu, that's cool. Or a Taoist, that's cool. A Christian, you're not Jewish. And he said it's just an incredibly ironic thing. Judaism has come to define itself as not Christian. Or, and even more narrowly, as not believing in Jesus, as not accepting Jesus. Well, where's that coming from? The Holocaust has something to do with that. The pogroms have something to do with that. There's a whole history behind that. And whatever the sources of it, there's this huge emotional prejudice that Jews are going to have to becoming Christians. Well, will they be damned for having an emotional prejudice that life has not given them enough time to resolve and come to terms with? I don't think so. I think they could be morally enlightened, I mean spiritually enlightened, and being sanctified by the Spirit of God, by the living God, but not be able to bring themselves to believe in Jesus yet. And I don't think that would damn them if the problem is not a moral blindness, but rather just an emotional prejudice. I don't think that would damn them. Now, I hope I'm not wrong about that, but I think that's true. So, do you see my difficulty in answering that? Ideally, how can you be a Christian and not believe in Jesus? On the other hand, yeah, actually, there's sort of a way, almost.
Well, I remember in another university I attended, I attended this group called the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and it seems like they had five beliefs. They had a list of five beliefs that you basically had to believe to be a Christian. I just recall that because some of these groups do have kind of a set group of beliefs that you're supposed to believe.
Yeah, see, what I want to say is, if we really want to get serious about making a list, we're going to end up with hundreds of beliefs. Because really, in the end, there's no end to the things that a person who has become enlightened and who is no longer morally blind is going to be open to believing and therefore will in time come to believe because they're true. You know? And the problem I have with groups that say, you know, there's just five beliefs that you have to believe, what that does is ultimately trivialize truth. Because what they're saying is, these truths, it matters if you believe them, but the rest of them, yeah, you can be this kind of Christian, or you can be this kind of Christian, you can be from this tradition, you can be from this tradition. You can have this theology, you can have this theology. You can believe in free will, you can believe in God's sovereignty. You know, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter.